burned, then the civilization of the 21st century would be wiped away in a matter of hours as the godlike creatures warred among themselves. It had happened before. Mythology and history recorded the event as the flood. Now Dee had the book. All he needed were the two pages Flamel could feel pressed against his flesh. And Nicholas Flamel knew that Dee and the Morrigan would stop at nothing to get those pages. Flamel hung his head and wished he knew what to do. He wished Perronel were with him. She would surely have a plan. A bubble burst on the surface of the water. "The lady asks me to tell you." Another bubble popped and burst. "That she is unharmed." Flamel scrambled back from the pool's edge. Tendrils of mist were rising from the surface of the water, tiny bubbles popping and snapping. A shape began to form out of the mist cloud, a surprising shape, that of an elderly man in a security guard's uniform. The shape hovered, twisting and curling over the pond. The late evening sunshine shone through the water drops, turning each one into a brilliant rainbow of light.
"You are a ghost?" Nicholas asked.
"Yes, sir, I am. Or I was, until Mrs. Flamel freed me."
"Do you know me?" Nicholas Flamel asked.
He wondered quickly if this might be a trick of Dee's, but then he dismissed the idea. The sorcerer was powerful, but there was no way he could penetrate Hecate's defenses. The mist shifted and thickened. "Yes, sir, I believe I do. You are Nicholas Flamel, the alchemist. Mrs. Flamel asked me to go in search of you. She suggested that I would find you here, in this particular shadow realm. She overheard Dee mention that you were here."
"She is unharmed?"
Flamel asked eagerly. "She is. The small man they call John Dee is terrified of her, though the other woman is not."
"What woman?"
"A tall woman, wearing a cloak of black feathers."
"The Morrigan," Flamel said grimly.
"Aye, and that's the message." A fish leapt out of the pond, and the figure dissolved into a thousand water droplets that hung frozen in the air, each one a tiny portion of a jigsaw that made up the ghost. "Mrs. Flamel says that you have to leave, and leave now. The Crow Goddess is gathering her forces to invade the Shadow Realm."
"She'll not succeed. She is next generation. She has not the power."
The fish leapt again, scattering the water droplets, and the ghost's voice drifted and whispered away, dying with each bursting bubble. "Mrs. Flamel instructed me to tell you that the Crow Goddess intends to awaken Bastet." Chapter 19. Skatok stood by the door to Sophie's room and regarded the twins with her grass-green eyes. "Get some rest," she said, repeating Flamel's advice.
"Stay in your rooms," she added. "You may hear strange sounds from outside. Just ignore them. You are completely safe so long as you remain within these walls."
"What sort of sounds?" Josh asked. His imagination was working overtime, and he was beginning to regret all those hours he'd spent playing Doom and Quake, scaring himself silly. Skatok took a moment to consider.
"Screams, maybe. Animal howls.
Oh, and laughter," she smiled.
"And believe me, you don't want to find out what's laughing," she said, and added, without a trace of irony, "Sleep tight."
Josh Newman waited until Skatok had rounded the end of the corridor before turning to his sister.
"We've got to get out of here."
Sophie chewed her bottom lip hard enough to leave the impression of her two front teeth in the flesh, and then nodded.
"I've been thinking the same thing."
"I think we're in some pretty serious danger," Josh said urgently.
Sophie nodded again. Events had moved so fast that afternoon that she'd barely had time to catch her breath. One moment she'd been working in the coffee shop, the next they were racing across San Francisco in the company of a man who claimed to be a 600-year-old alchemist, and a girl who looked no older than herself and yet who Flamel swore was a 2,500-year-old female warrior. And a vampire.
"I keep looking for the hidden cameras," she muttered, glancing around the room.
Cameras?
Josh looked startled. He immediately picked up on his twin's thoughts.
You mean, like, candid camera?
He looked uncomfortable and felt color flood his face. What if he'd managed to make an idiot of himself in front of the entire nation? He'd never be able to show his face at school again.
He peered up into the corners of the room, looking for the cameras. They were usually behind mirrors.
There were no mirrors in the room, but Josh knew that didn't mean anything. The new generation of cameras were so small that they were virtually invisible.
A sudden thought struck him. What about the birds?
Sophie nodded once more.
I keep coming back to the birds. Everything else could be special effects. The Torc Alta could be trained animals and men in prosthetic makeup. What happened in Skatok's dojo could be some sort of effect, and the rats could have been trained. But not the birds. There were too many of them, and they ripped the car to shreds.
The birds were what had finally convinced her that she and Josh were in very real danger. Because if the birds were real, then everything else was real too. Josh dug his hands into the back pockets of his jeans and stood by the open window. The dense foliage came right up to the window ledge, and although there was no glass in the opening, none of the myriad bugs that flitted through the late evening air entered the room. He recoiled as a bright blue snake, as thick as his wrist, appeared out of the canopy of leaves and flickered a tongue that was easily 6 inches long in his direction. The snake vanished as a ball of tiny buzzing lights appeared, darting smoothly through the trees. As they shot past the window, Josh could have sworn that the entire swarm was composed of about a dozen tiny winged women, none of them bigger than his forefinger. The lights came from within their bodies. He licked dry lips.
Okay, let's assume that this is real, all of it. The magic, the ancient races. Then that brings me back to my original thought. We've got to get out of here.
Sophie walked to the window, stood behind her brother, and put her arm on his shoulder. She was older than he was by 28 seconds. Less than half a minute, Josh always reminded her. But with their mother and father away so much, she had assumed the role of a much older sister. Although he was already a good 2 inches taller than she was, he would always be her baby brother.
I agree, she said tiredly. We should try and make a run for it.
Something in his sister's voice made Josh turn to look at her.
You don't think we'll get away, he said evenly.
Let's try, she said, not answering his question. But I'm sure they'll come after us.
Flamel said that Dee would be able to track us. I'm sure Flamel or Skatok can do that too.
Flamel has no reason to follow us, Sophie pointed out.
But Dee does, Josh said. What happens if we go home and Dee and his people follow us there?
He wondered aloud.
Sophie frowned. I've been thinking about that. Flamel said that we'll be able to see the magical aura that surrounds people.
Josh nodded.
Hecate hasn't awakened our magical powers.
She frowned again, trying to remember exactly what Nicholas Flamel had said.
Flamel said we smelled of wild magic.
Josh sniffed deeply. But I can't smell anything. No fruit or oranges or vanilla ice cream. Maybe we don't smell until that happens.
If we managed to make it back home, we could head out to Utah, to Mom and Dad. We could stay with them for the rest of the summer until all this blows over.
That's not a bad idea, Josh said.
No one would find us in the desert. And right now, the hot, boring, sandy desert sounds really attractive.
Sophie turned to look at the door. There's only one problem. This place is a maze. Do you think you can find the way back to the car?
I think so, he nodded.
Actually, I'm sure of it. Let's go then.
She checked her pocket for her dead cell phone.
Let's get your stuff.
The twins paused by the door of Sophie's room and peered up and down the corridor. It was deserted and in almost total darkness, except where irregular clumps of arm-length crystals emitted a milky white light. Somewhere in the distance, a sound that was caught between laughter and screaming echoed down the corridors. With her rubber-soled sneakers making no sound on the floor, they darted across the corridor into Josh's room.
How did we ever get into this mess?
Josh wondered out loud. I guess we were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, Sophie said. She had remained standing by the door, watching the corridor. But even as she was saying the words, she was beginning to suspect that there was more to it than that. There was something else going on, something to do with the prophecy that Flamel had referred to, something to do with them. And the very idea terrified her. The twins slipped into the corridor and moved through the circular rooms, taking their time, peering into each one before entering. They kept stopping, listening as snatches of conversations in almost recognizable languages or music played on unidentifiable instruments floated down the corridor. Once, a high-pitched howl of maniacal laughter sent them ducking into the nearest room, as it seemed to approach, then disappear again. When they crept back out of the room, they noticed that all the light crystals in the corridor had dimmed to a blood-red glow. I'm glad we didn't see what passed by, Josh said shakily. Sophie grunted a response. Her brother was in the lead. She followed two steps behind, her hand on his shoulder.
How do you know where we're going? She whispered, bringing her mouth close to his ear.
All the rooms looked identical to her. When we first came into the house, I noticed that the walls and floor were dark. But as we moved down the corridors, they became lighter and paler in color. Then I realized that we were walking through different shades of wood, like the rings of a tree trunk. All we have to do is to follow the corridor that leads to the dark wood.
Smart, Sophie said, impressed.
Josh glanced over his shoulder and grinned. Told you those video games weren't a waste of time. The only way not to get lost in the maze games is to watch for clues, like patterns on the walls or ceilings, and to keep a note of your steps so you can retrace them if you need to. He stepped out into a corridor. And if I'm right, the main door should be there, he finished triumphantly.
The twins fled across the vast open field in front of the huge treehouse and made their way to the tree-lined pathway that led back to the car. Even though night had fallen, they had no problem seeing. The moon hung bright and low in the heavens, and the sky was filled with an extraordinary number of brilliant stars, which combined with a swirling band of silvery dust high in the sky to give the night a peculiar grayish luminescence. Only the shadows remained pitch black.
Although it wasn't cold, Sophie shivered. The night felt wrong.
Josh pulled off his hooded sweatshirt and draped it over his sister's shoulders.
The stars are different, she muttered. They're so bright.
Craning her neck, she looked up into the heavens, trying to peer through the branches of the Yggdrasil.
I can't see the Big Dipper, and the North Star is missing.
And there was no moon last night, Josh said, nodding to where the full moon was rising huge and yellow-white over the treetops.
No moon in our world, he added solemnly.
Sophie stared hard at the moon. There was something about it, something wrong. She tried to identify the familiar craters, and then felt her stomach lurch with a sudden realization. Her hand, when she pointed upward, was trembling.
That's not our moon!
Josh looked hard, squinting against the glare. Then he saw what his sister was talking about.
The surface is different. Smoother, he said softly.
Where are the craters? I can't see Kepler, Copernicus, or even Tycho.
Josh, Sophie said quickly, I think we're looking at the night sky as it was thousands of years ago, maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Sophie tilted her head and looked up. Josh was startled to see that the moonlight gave her face a skeletal appearance, and he quickly looked away, disturbed. He had always been close to his sister, but the last few hours had served to remind him just how important she was to him.
Didn't Skatok say that Hecate had created this shadow realm? Josh asked. I bet it's modeled on the world she remembered.
So this is the night sky and the moon as they were thousands of years ago, Sophie said in awe.
She wished she had her digital camera with her, just to capture the extraordinary image of the smooth-faced moon. The twins were looking into the heavens when a shadow flickered across the face of the moon, a speck that might have been a bird,
except that the wingspan was too wide, and no bird had that serpent-like neck and tail. Josh grabbed his sister's hand and pulled her toward the car. "I'm really beginning to hate this place," he grumbled. The SUV was where they had left it, parked in the center of the path. The moon washed yellow light across the shattered windshield, the broken patterns in the starred glass picked out in shadow. The brilliance also highlighted the scars on the car's body, the scratches and gouges in sharp relief. The roof was studded with hundreds of tiny holes where the birds had pecked through the metal. The rear window wiper dangled by a thread of rubber, and the two side mirrors were completely missing. The twins regarded the SUV silently, the full realization of the bird attack beginning to sink in. Sophie ran a finger down a series of scratches in the window on the passenger side of the car. Those few millimeters of glass were all that had protected her flesh from the bird's claws. "Let's go," Josh said, pulling open the door and sliding into the driver's seat. The keys were where he had left them, in the ignition. "I feel a little bad running out on Nicholas and Scatty without saying anything," Sophie said as she pulled open the door and climbed in. But the immortal alchemist and the warrior would be better off without them, she reckoned. They were more than able to defend themselves. The last thing they needed was two teenagers slowing them down. "We'll apologize if we ever see them again," Josh said. He privately thought he would be happy never to see either of them again. Playing video games was all fine and well. When you were killed in a game, you just started again. In this shadow realm, though, there were no second chances, and a lot more ways to die.
"Do you know how we get out of here?" Sophie asked.
"Sure," her brother grinned, his teeth white in the moonlight. "We reverse, and we don't stop for anything." Josh turned the key in the ignition. There was a metallic click and a whining sound, which quickly descended into silence. He turned the key again. This time, there was only the click.
"Josh?" Sophie began.
It took him just a moment to figure out what had happened. "The battery's dead. Probably drained by the same force that drained our phones," Josh murmured. He swiveled around in the seat to stare through the scarred rear window.
"Look, we came down that path behind us. We didn't turn left or right. Let's make a run for it. What do you think?"
He turned back to look at his sister, but she wasn't looking at him. She was staring through the windshield in front of her.
"You're not even listening to me."
Sophie reached over, took her twin's face in her hand, and turned his head toward the windshield. He looked, blinked, swallowed hard, then reached over to push down the locks on the doors.
"What now?" he asked.
Crouching directly in front of them was a creature that was neither bird nor serpent, but something caught in between. It stood about the size of a tall child. Moonlight dappled its snake-like body and shone weakly through outstretched bat-like wings, the tiny bones and veins etched in black. Clawed feet dug deeply into the soft ground, and a long tail lashed to and fro behind it. But it was the head that held their attention. The skull was long and narrow, eyes huge and round, the gaping mouth filled with hundreds of tiny white teeth. The head tilted first to one side and then the other, and then the mouth snapped open and closed. The creature took a hop closer to the car. There was movement in the air behind it, and a second creature, even bigger than the first, dropped from the night skies. It folded its wings and stood upright as it turned its hideous head toward the car.
"Maybe they're vegetarians," Josh suggested.
Leaning over the driver's seat, he rummaged in the back of the car, looking for something he could use as a weapon.
"Not with those teeth," his sister said grimly. "I think they're pterosaurs," she said,
remembering the huge, suspended skeleton she had seen in the Texas Natural Science Center.
"Like pterodactyls?"
Josh asked, turning back. He had found a small fire extinguisher.
"Pterosaurs are older," Sophie said.
A third pterosaur dropped from the night sky, and like three hunched old men, the creatures began to advance on the car.
"We should have stayed in the tree," Sophie muttered.
They'd been warned, hadn't they?
Stay in your rooms, don't leave. And after everything they'd seen so far, they should have guessed that Hecate's shadow realm at night was a dangerous and deadly place. Now they were facing something out of the Cretaceous period. Josh opened his mouth to reply, then closed it again. He pulled the retaining pin out of the fire extinguisher, arming it. He wasn't sure what would happen if he fired off a blast of the gas at them. The three creatures split up. One approached from the front of the car. The remaining two moved toward the driver and passenger windows.
"Wish we knew some magic now,"
Sophie said fervently. She could feel her heart tripping in her chest and was aware that her tongue seemed far too large for her mouth. She felt breathless and lightheaded. The largest pterosaur leaned across the hood of the car, resting its huge wings on the scarred metal to support itself. Its long, snake-like head darted forward to peer into the body of the car, and it slowly looked from Sophie to Josh, and then back to Sophie. Seen this close, its mouth was enormous, its teeth endless. Josh positioned the nozzle of the fire extinguisher against one of the many holes in the windshield and aimed it at the pterosaur. His eyes were darting left and right, watching the approach of the other two creatures, and his hands were sweating so heavily that he was finding it difficult to hold the fire extinguisher.
"Josh," Sophie whispered, "do something! Do something now!"
"Maybe the gas in the extinguisher will scare them away," Josh replied, unconsciously lowering his voice to a whisper. "Or poison them or something."
"And why would you want to do that?"
The pterosaur tilted its head to look at Josh, mouth working, teeth glinting. The words were full of clicking pops and stops, but the language was English.
"We are not your enemy."
Chapter 20. Even for Bel Air, the area of L.A. renowned for its extravagant properties, the house was extraordinary. Vast and sprawling, built entirely of white travertine marble, and accessible only by a private road, it occupied a 60-acre estate, surrounded by a 12-foot wall topped by an electric fence. Dr. John D. had to wait for 10 minutes outside the closed gates while an armed security guard checked his identity, and another guard examined every inch of the car, even scanned beneath it with a small camera. D. was glad he'd chosen the commercial limousine service with a human driver. He wasn't sure what the guards would have made of a mud golem. D. had flown in from San Francisco late in the afternoon on his private jet. The limousine, booked by his office, had picked him up from Burbank, now renamed Bob Hope Airport, he noted, and driven him down to Sunset Boulevard through some of the most appalling traffic he had encountered since he lived in Victorian London. For the first time in his very long life, D felt as if events were slipping out of his control. They were moving too quickly, and in his experience, that was when accidents happen. He was being rushed by people, well, not people exactly, more beings, too eager for results. They had made him move against Flamel today, even though he told them he needed another few days of preparation. And he'd been right. 24 more hours of planning and surveillance would have enabled him to snatch Nicholas as well as Perronel and the entire Codex. D had warned his employers that Nicholas Flamel could be tricky indeed, but they hadn't listened to him. D knew Flamel better than anyone. Over the centuries, he had come close to catching him, very close, but on every occasion, Flamel and Perronel had managed to slip away. Sitting back in the air-conditioned car while the guards continued their inspections, he recalled the first time he had met the famous alchemist, Nicholas Flamel. John Dee was born in 1527. His was the world of Queen Elizabeth I, and he had served the Queen in many capacities, as an advisor and a translator, a mathematician and an astronomer, and a personal astrologer. It had been left to him to choose the date of her coronation, and he had picked noon on January 15th, 1559. He promised the young princess that hers would be a long reign. It lasted for 45 years. Dr. John Dee was also the Queen's spy. Dee spied for the English Queen across Europe and was her most influential and powerful agent operating on the continent.
As a renowned scholar and scientist, magician and alchemist, he was welcomed at the courts of kings and the palaces of nobles. He professed to speak only English, Latin, and Greek, though in actuality he spoke a dozen languages well and understood at least a dozen more, even Arabic and a smattering of the language of Cathay. He learned early on that people were often indiscreet when they didn't know that he understood their every word, and he used that to his fullest advantage. D signed his confidential encoded reports with the numbers 007. He thought it wonderfully ironic that hundreds of years later, when Ian Fleming created James Bond, he gave Bond the same codename. John Dee was one of the most powerful magicians of his age. He had mastered necromancy and sorcery, astrology and mathematics, divination and scrying. His journeys across Europe brought him into contact with all the great magicians and sorcerers of that time, including the legendary Nicholas Flamel, the man known as the Alchemist. Dee discovered the existence of Nicholas Flamel, who had supposedly died in 1418 entirely by accident. That encounter was to shape the rest of his life and, in so many ways, influence the history of the world. Nicholas and Perronel had returned to Paris in the first decade of the 16th century and were working as physicians, tending to the poor and sick in the very hospitals the Flamels had founded more than 100 years earlier. They were living and working virtually in the shadow of the great cathedral of Notre Dame. Dee was in Paris on a secret mission for the Queen, but the moment he saw the slender dark-haired man and his green-eyed wife working together in the high-ceiling wards of the hospital, he knew who they were. Dee was one of the few people in the world who had a copy of Flamel's masterwork, The Summary of Philosophy, which included an engraving of the famous alchemist opposite the title page. When Dee had introduced himself to the doctor and his wife, calling them by their true names, neither had denied it. Of course, they also knew of the famous Dr. John Dee by reputation. Although Perronel had had some reservations, Nicholas had been delighted with the opportunity to take on the English magician as a new apprentice. Dee had immediately left England and spent the next 4 years training with Nicholas and Perronel in Paris. And it was in Paris, in the year 1575, when he had first learned of the existence of the Elder Race. He had been studying late at night in his tiny attic room in Flamel's house when a creature out of a nightmare had slithered down the chimney, scattering coal and wood as it crawled out onto the scorched mat. The creature was a gargoyle, one of the ancient breed of ghouls that infested the sewers and graveyards of most European cities. Similar to the crude shapes carved in stone that decorated the cathedral almost directly opposite the house, this was a living creature of veined, marble-like flesh and cinder-black eyes. Speaking in an archaic form of Greek, the gargoyle invited him to a meeting on the roof of the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Recognizing that this invitation was not one he could refuse, Dee followed the creature into the night. Loping along, sometimes on two legs, often on four, the gargoyle led him through increasingly narrow alleys, then down into the sewers, and eventually into a secret passageway that took him deep within the great cathedral's walls. He followed the gargoyle up the 1,001 steps carved into the interior of the wall that finally led onto the roof of the Gothic cathedral.
"Wait,"
it had commanded, and then said no more. Its mission accomplished, the gargoyle ignored Dee and settled down on the parapet, hunched forward, wings folded over its shoulders, tail curled tightly against its back, tiny horns visible as they jutted from its forehead. It peered over the square far below, tracking the movements of the late-night stragglers or those who had no homes to go to, looking for a suitable meal. If anyone had chanced to glance up, the gargoyle would have been indistinguishable from any of the countless stone carvings on the building. Dee had walked to the edge of the roof and looked across the city. All of nighttime Paris was laid out below him, thousands of winking lights from cooking fires, oil lamps, and candles, the smoke rising straight up into the still air, the countless dots of light split by the black curve of the Seine. From this height, Dee could hear the buzz of the city, a low drone, like a beehive settling down for the night, and smell the noxious stench that hung over the streets. A combination of sewers, rotting fruit, and spoiled meat, human and animal sweat, and the stink of the river itself. Perched over the cathedral's famous rose window, Dee waited. The study of magic had taught him many things, especially the value of patience. The scholar in him enjoyed the experience of standing on the roof of the tallest building in Paris, and he wished he'd brought his sketchpad with him. He contented himself with looking around, committing everything he saw to his incredible memory. He recalled a recent visit to Florence. He had gone there to examine the diaries of Leonardo da Vinci. They were written in a strange cipher which no one had been able to break. It had taken him less than an hour to crack the code. No one had realized that Leonardo had written his diaries not only in code, but in mirror image. The diaries were full of many amazing drawings for proposed inventions, guns that fired many times, an armored coach that moved without the need of horses, and a craft that could sail beneath the sea. There was one, however, that particularly interested Dee, a harness that Da Vinci claimed would allow a man to take to the air and fly like a bird. Dee had not been entirely convinced that the design would work, though he wanted nothing more in the world than to fly. Looking out over Paris now, he began to imagine what it would be like to strap Da Vinci's wings to his arms and sail out over the roofs. His thoughts were interrupted as a flicker of movement caught his attention. He turned to the north, where a shape was moving in the night sky, a black shadow trailing scores of smaller dots. The smaller shapes looked as if they could be birds, except that he knew that birds rarely flew at night. Dee knew immediately and without question that this was what he had been brought up here to meet. He concentrated on the larger shape as it came closer, trying to make sense of what he was seeing, but it was only when the figure dropped onto the roof that he realized he was looking at an ashen-faced woman dressed entirely in black, wearing a long cloak of crow's wings. That night, Dr. John Dee first met the Morrigan. That night, he learned of the elder race and how they had been forced from the world of men by the magic in the Book of Abraham the Mage, a book that was currently in the possession of Nicholas Flamel. That night, Dee learned that there were those among the elders who wanted to return to their rightful place as the rulers of mankind. And that night, the crow goddess promised Dee that he would one day control the entire world. He would be master of an empire that stretched from pole to pole, from sunrise to sunset. All he had to do was to steal the book from Flamel and hand it over. That night, Dr. John Dee became the champion of the Dark Elders. It was a mission that had taken him across the world and into the many shadow realms that bordered it. He had fought ghosts and ghouls, creatures that had no right to exist outside of nightmares, others that were left over from a time predating the arrival of the humani. He had gone to battle at the head of an army of monsters and had spent at least a decade wandering lost in an icy otherworld. Many times he had been concerned for his safety, but he had never been truly frightened until this moment, sitting before the entrance to a Bel Air estate in 21st century Los Angeles. In those early days, he had not been fully aware of the powers of the creatures he served, but nearly 4.5 centuries in their service had taught him many things, including the fact that death was probably the least of all the punishments they could inflict on him. The armed security guard stepped back, and the high metal gates clicked open, allowing Dee's car to sweep in on the long white stone driveway toward the sprawling marble mansion that was just visible through the trees. Although night had fallen, no lights were showing in the house, and for a moment Dee imagined that no one was at home. Then he remembered that the person, the creature, he had come to meet preferred the hours of darkness and had no need of lights. The car turned into the circular drive in front of the main entrance, where the headlights picked up a trio of people standing on the bottom step. When the car finally crunched to a halt on the white gravel, a figure stepped up to the door and pulled it open. It was impossible to make out any details in the gloom, but the voice that came out of the darkness was male and spoke to him in heavily accented English.
Doc Dardy, I presume. I am Senyuhet. Please, come in. We've been expecting you.
Then the figure turned away and strode up the steps. Dee climbed out of the car, brushed off his expensive suit, and, conscious that his heart was fluttering, followed Senyuhet into the mansion. The other two figures fell into step on either side of him. Although no one said anything, Dee knew they were guards, and he wasn't entirely sure they were human. The magician recognized the heavy, cloying scent as soon as he stepped into the house. It was frankincense, the rare and incredibly expensive aromatic gum from the Middle East, used in ancient times in Egypt and Greece, and as far to the east as China. Dee felt his eyes water and his nose twitch. Those of the elder race were particularly fond of frankincense, but it gave him a headache. As the three shadowy figures led Dee into the great hallway, he caught a glimpse of Senyuhet, a small, slender man, bald and olive-skinned. He looked as if he was of Middle Eastern origin, from Egypt or Yemen. Senyuhet pushed close the heavy front door, spoke two words, "Stay here," and then disappeared into the darkness, leaving Dee in the company of the two silent guards. Dee looked around. Even in the shadowy half-light, he could see that the hallway was bare. There was no furniture on the tiled floor. There were no pictures or mirrors on the walls, no curtains on the windows. He knew that there were houses like this scattered across the world, homes to those few dark elders who liked to walk in the world of men, usually creating mischief. Though they were extraordinarily skilled and dangerous, their powers were extremely limited because of the proliferation of iron in the modern world, which served to dull their magical energies. In the way that lead was poisonous to humans, iron, the metal of mankind, was deadly to the elder race. Dee knew, even without looking, that there would not be a scrap of that particular metal in this house. Everything would be made of gold or silver, even down to the door handles and the taps in the bathrooms. The dark elders valued their privacy. Their preference was for quiet, out-of-the-way places, small islands, patches of desert, countries like Switzerland, portions of the former Soviet Union, the Arctic reaches of Canada, Himalayan temples, and the Brazilian jungle. When they chose to live in cities like this one, their houses were secured behind walls and wire, the grounds patrolled by armed guards and dogs. And if anyone was lucky or foolish enough to actually reach the house, they would encounter older, darker, and more lethal guards.
This way.
Dee was pleased that he'd managed to control his fright at the sound of Senyuhet's voice. He hadn't heard the man return. Would they go up or down, he wondered. In his experience, those of the elder race fell into two neat categories: those who preferred to sleep on roofs and those who preferred basements. The Morrigan was a creature of attics and roofs. Senyuhet stepped into a puddle of light, and Dee noted now that his eyes were painted with black coal, the top lid completely blackened, two horizontal lines running from the corner of his eyes to his ears. Three vertical white lines were painted on his chin, beneath his lips. He led Dee to a concealed door directly under the broad staircase, and opened it with a password in the language that the boy king Tutankhamun would have spoken. Dee followed the figure into a pitch-black corridor and stopped when the door clicked shut behind him. He heard the man moving ahead of him, then his footsteps clicking on stairs. Dee should have guessed that the dark elder the Morrigan had sent him to see would be a creature of basements and tunnels.
"I'll need light," he said aloud. "I don't want to fall down the stairs in the dark and break my neck."
His voice echoed slightly in the confined space.
"There is no electricity in this house, Dr. Jandi. But we have heard that you are a magician of note. If you wish to create light, then you are permitted to do so."
Without a word, Dee stretched out his hand. A blue spark snapped to life in his palm. It buzzed and hissed, spinning about, then it started to grow, from the size of a pea to that of a grape. It gave off a cold blue-white light. Holding his hand out in front of him, Dee started down the stairs. He began to count the steps as he descended, but quickly gave up, distracted by the decorations on the walls, the ceilings, and even the floor. It was like stepping into an Egyptian tomb, but, unlike any of the countless tombs he had seen, where the artwork was faded, chipped, and broken, and everything was coated in a fine layer of gritty sand, here the decorations were pristine, brilliant, and complete. The colors, slightly distorted by the blue light he was carrying, looked as if they had just been laid down. The pictographs and hieroglyphs were vivid and crisp, the names of gods picked out in thick gold leaf. A sudden updraft caused the blue-white ball of light to flicker and dance in his hand, sending the shadows leaping and darting. Dee's nostrils flared. The wind carried the stench of something old, old, and long dead. The stairs ended in a wide vaulted cellar. Dee felt something crunch and snap beneath his feet with his first step. He lowered his hand, and the blue-white light shone across the floor, which was covered with countless tiny white bones, blanketing the ground in an ivory carpet. It took Dee a long moment before he recognized the bones as those of rats and mice. Some of them were so old that they crumbled into white powder when he disturbed them, but others were much newer. Unwilling to ask a question to which he really did not want an answer, Dee followed his silent guide, bones crunching and crackling with every step. He lifted his hand high, shedding light across the chamber. Unlike the stairwell, however, this room was unadorned, the walls streaked black with moisture, green mold gathering close to the floor, sprouting fungi dappling the ceiling. "Looks like you have a problem with damp," Dee said unnecessarily, simply to break the growing silence.
"It is of no matter," Senuhet said quietly.
"Have you been here long?" Dee wondered, glancing around.
"In this place?"
The other man paused, considering.
"Less than 100 years. No time at all, really."
A shape moved in the shadows.
"And we will not be here much longer. That is why you are here, isn't it, Dr. Dee?"
The voice was a cross between a sultry growl and a purr, shaping the English words with difficulty. Almost against his will, Dee raised his hand, allowing the light in his palm to illuminate the tall, slender figure that moved in the gloom. The light moved over bare feet, toenails black and pointed like claws, then up a heavy white kilt-like skirt studded with stones and precious jewels, and a chest crisscrossed with wide straps etched with Egyptian characters, and finally reached the head. Although he knew what he was going to see, Dee couldn't prevent the gasp of shock from escaping his lips as he looked at Bastet. The body was that of a woman, but the head that brushed the arch ceiling belonged to a cat, sleek and furred, with huge yellow slit-pupiled eyes, a long pointed snout, and high triangular ears. The mouth opened, and Dee's cold light ran across gleaming yellow teeth. This was the creature that had been worshipped for generations throughout the land of Egypt. Dee licked dry lips as he bowed deeply.
"Your niece, the Morrigan, sends her regards, and has asked me to relay the message that it is time to take your revenge on the three-faced one."
Bastet surged forward and wrapped razor-tipped claws in the folds of Dee's expensive suit coat, punching holes in the silk.
"Precisely. Tell me precisely what my niece said," she demanded.
"I've told you," Dee said, looking up into the terrifying face. Bastet's breath smelled of rotten meat. He tossed the blue-white ball of light into the air where it hung, suspended and whirling. Then he carefully removed Bastet's claws from his jacket. The coat was a shredded ruin.
"The Morrigan wants you to join her in an attack on Hecate's Shadow Realm," Dee said simply.
"Then it is time,"
Bastet announced triumphantly. The ancient magician nodded, shadows racing and dancing on the walls with the movement.
"It is time,"
he agreed. Time for the Elder Race to return and reclaim this Earth. Bastet howled, the sound high-pitched and terrifying. And then the darkness behind her boiled and shifted as thousands of cats of every breed, of all shapes and sizes, poured into the cellar and gathered around her in an ever-widening circle.
"It is time to hunt," she announced. "Time to feed."
The cats threw back their heads and mewled and howled. Dee found the din utterly terrifying. It sounded like countless lost babies crying. Chapter 21 Skatok was waiting by the enormous open doors when Sophie and Josh returned to the tree. The pterosaur hopped along behind them, and the other two circled low in the sky over their heads, the downdraft of their wings setting eddies of dust circling and dancing around them. Although nothing was said, the twins knew they were being gently, but firmly, herded back toward the house. In the gloom, Skatok's face was unnaturally pale, her cropped red hair black in the shadows. Although her lips were set in a grim line, her voice, when she spoke, was carefully neutral.
"Do you really want me to tell you just how stupidly dangerous that was?"
Josh opened his mouth to reply, but Sophie caught his arm, silencing him.
"We just wanted to go home,"
she said simply, tiredly. She already knew what the warrior was going to say.
"You cannot,"
Skatok said and turned away. The twins hesitated at the door, then turned to look back at the pterosaur. It tilted its snake-like head and regarded them with a huge, slit-pupiled eye, and its voice echoed flatly in their heads.
"Don't worry too much about Skatok. Her bark is much worse than her bite."
The creature opened its mouth to show hundreds of triangular teeth in what might have been a smile.
"I do believe she was worried about you,"
it added, then turned away, ran in a series of short hops, and took to the air with a crack of wings.
"Don't say a word,"
Sophie warned her brother. Josh's quips and comments were always getting him into trouble. Whereas Sophie had the ability to see something and keep her mouth shut, her brother always had to make a comment or observation.
"You're not the boss of me,"
Josh snapped, but his voice was shaky. Josh had a fear of snakes, going back to the time he'd gone camping with their father and he had fallen into a rattlesnake nest. Luckily, the deadly serpent had just fed and had chosen to ignore him, giving him the seconds he'd needed to scramble away. He'd had nightmares about snakes for weeks after that, and still did occasionally, when he was particularly stressed, usually at exam time. The huge, serpent-like pterosaurs belonged to his darkest nightmares, and when they'd come hopping out of the night, he'd felt his heart hammering so powerfully that the skin on his chest had actually pulsed. When that long-toothed face had leaned toward him, he'd been sure he was going to faint. Even now, he could feel the icy sweat trickling along the length of his spine. Sophie and Josh followed Skatok through Hecate's house. The twins were aware now of movement in the shadows, floorboards creaking underfoot, wooden walls popping and cracking, as if the house were moving, shifting, growing. They were also conscious that the voices, the screams and shouts of earlier, had fallen silent. Skatok led them to an empty circular room where Nicholas Flamel was waiting. He stood facing away from them, hands clasped tightly against the small of his back, and stared out into the shadowed night. The only light in the room came from the huge moon now starting to dip toward the horizon. One side of the room was bathed in harsh silver-white light, the other was in darkness. Skadi crossed the room to stand beside the alchemist. She folded her arms across her chest and turned to the twins, her face an expressionless mask.
"You could have been killed," Flamel said very softly, without turning around. "Or worse."
"You can't keep us here," Josh said quickly,
his voice sounding too loud in the silence.
"We're not your prisoners."
The alchemist glanced over his shoulder. He was wearing his tiny round glasses and, in the gloom, his eyes were hidden behind the silver circles.
"No, you're not. he said very quietly, his French accent suddenly pronounced. You are the prisoners, a circumstance, of coincidence and chance, if you believe in such things.
I don't, Skatok muttered.
Neither do I, Nicholas said, turning around. He took off his glasses and squeezed the bridge of his nose. There were dark circles under his pale eyes, and his lips were pinched in a thin line. We are all prisoners of a sort here, prisoners of circumstance and events. Nearly 700 years ago, I bought a battered second-hand book written in an incomprehensible language. That day, I too became a prisoner, trapped as securely as if I were behind bars. 2 months ago, Josh, you should never have asked me for a job, and you, Sophie, should never have started working in the coffee cup. But you did, and because you made those decisions, you are both standing here with me tonight. He paused and glanced at Skatok. Of course, there is a school of thought that suggests that you were fated to take the jobs, to meet Paranel and me, and to come on this adventure. Skatok nodded.
Destiny, she said. You're saying that we have no free will? Sophie asked. That all this was meant to happen?
She shook her head.
I don't, for 1 minute, believe that.
The very idea went against everything she believed. The idea that the future could be foretold was simply ludicrous.
Neither do I,
Josh said defiantly.
And yet, Flamel said very softly, what if I were to tell you that the Book of the Mage, a book written more than 10,000 years ago, speaks of you?
That's impossible, Josh blurted, terrified by the implications.
Ha! Nicholas Flamel spread his arms wide.
And is this not impossible? Tonight you encountered the Nahair, the winged guardians of Hecate's realm. You heard their voices in your heads. Are they not impossible? And the Torque Alta, are they not equally impossible? These are creatures that have no right to exist outside of myth.
And what about us? Skatok asked. Nicholas is nearly 700 years old, and I am so old I have seen empires rise and fall. Are we not equally impossible?
Neither Josh nor Sophie could deny that. Nicholas stepped forward and put a hand on Josh's and Sophie's shoulders. He was no taller than they were and looked directly into their eyes.
You must accept that you are trapped in this impossible world. If you leave, you will bring destruction onto your family and friends, and in all probability, you will bring about your own deaths.
Besides, Skatok added bitterly, if you're mentioned in the book, then you're supposed to be here.
The twins looked from Skatty to Flamel. He nodded.
It's true. The book is full of prophecies, some of which have certainly come true, others which may yet come to pass. But it does specifically mention the two that are one.
And you believe? Sophie whispered.
Yes. I believe you may be the prophecy. In fact, I'm convinced of it.
Skatok stepped forward to stand beside Flamel.
Which means that you are suddenly much more important, not only to us, but also to Dee and the Dark Elders.
Why? Josh licked dry lips.
Why are we so important?
The alchemist glanced at Skadi for support. She nodded.
Tell them. They need to know.
The twins looked from Skadi back to the alchemist. There was a sense that what he was about to tell them was of immense importance. Sophie slipped her hand into her brother's, and he squeezed her fingers tightly.
The Codex prophesies that the two that are one will come either to save or to destroy the world.
What do you mean, either save or destroy? Josh demanded. It's got to be one or the other, right?
The word used in the Codex is similar to an ancient Babylonian symbol that can mean either thing, Flamel explained. Actually, I've always suspected that it means that one of you has the potential to save the world, while the other has the power to destroy it.
Sophie nudged her brother in the ribs.
That would be you.
Flamel stepped back from the twins. In a couple of hours, when Hecate arises, I will ask her to awaken your magical potential. I believe she will do it. I hope and pray that she does, he added fervently. Then we will leave.
But where are we going? Josh asked at the same time that Sophie said, will Hecate not allow us to stay here?
I'm hoping some of the other elders or immortal humans might be persuaded to help train you. And no, we cannot stay here. Dee and the Morrigan have contacted one of the most fearsome of the elders, Bastet.
The Egyptian cat goddess? Sophie asked.
Flamel blinked in surprise.
I'm impressed. Our parents are archaeologists, remember? While other children were being read bedtime stories, our parents told us myths and legends.
The alchemist nodded. Even as we speak, Bastet and the Morrigan are gathering their forces for an all-out attack on Hecate's Shadow Realm. I suspected that they would try and attack during the hours of darkness, when Hecate is sleeping, but so far there is no sign of them, and it will be dawn soon. I'm sure they know that they will only get one chance, and they need all their forces in place before they attack. At the moment, they believe we are still ignorant of their intentions. More importantly, they do not know that we are aware of Bastet's involvement. But we will be ready for them.
How do we know? Sophie asked.
Perenel told me, Flamel said, and waved away the next obvious question. She is a resourceful woman. She enlisted a disembodied spirit to pass on a message to me.
A disembodied spirit? Sophie said. You mean like a ghost?
She realized that now it was quite easy to believe in ghosts.
Just so, Flamel said. What will happen if they attack here? I mean, what kind of attack are we talking about? Josh asked.
Flamel looked at Scatty. I was not alive the last time beings of the Elder Race warred with one another.
I was, Scatty said glumly. The vast majority of humani will not even know anything is happening.
She shrugged.
But the release of magical energies in the Shadow Realms will certainly have an effect on the climate and local geology. There may be earthquakes, a tornado or two, hurricanes, and rain, lots of rain. And I really hate the rain, she added. One of the reasons I left Hibernia.
There must be something we can do, Sophie said. We have to warn people.
And what form would that warning take? Flamel asked. That there is about to be a magical battle that may cause earthquakes and flooding? Not something you can phone in to your local news or weather station, is it?
We have to...
No, we don't, the alchemist said firmly. We have to get you and the pages from the book away from here.
What about Hecate? Josh asked. Will she be able to defend herself?
Against Dee and the Morrigan, yes. But with Bastet as her ally, I simply don't know, Scatty answered. I don't know how powerful the goddess is.
More powerful than you can imagine.
They all turned toward the door, where a girl, who looked no older than 11, stood blinking and yawning widely. She rubbed a hand against her bright yellow eyes and stared at them, then smiled, her teeth startlingly white against her jet-black skin. She was wearing a short toga-like robe of the same iridescent material that the crone Hecate had worn, but this time the dress was streaked with golds and greens. Her ice-white hair curled down to her shoulders.
The alchemist bowed. Good morning. I did not think you rose before the dawn.
How could I sleep with all this activity?
Hecate demanded.
The house awakened me.
The house?
Josh began.
The house, Hecate said flatly, is alive.
There were a dozen comments Josh could have made, but remembering the green slime from the previous night, he wisely decided to keep his mouth shut.
I understand that the Morrigan and my elder sister Bastet are planning an assault on my Shadow Realm, the girl said grimly.
Nicholas glanced quickly at Skatok, who shifted her shoulders slightly in a shrug. She had no idea how Hecate knew.
I am sure you understand that everything that happens in this house, every word said or whispered or even thought,
Hecate added, glancing sidelong at Josh,
I hear.
The girl smiled, and in that instant looked like the older versions of herself. The smile curled her lips, but did not light up her eyes. She walked into the room, and Sophie noticed that as she moved, the house reacted to her presence. Where she had stood in the doorway, green shoots had sprouted, and the lintel and door sill had blossomed tiny green flowers. The goddess with three faces stopped before Nicholas Flamel and looked up into his troubled eyes.
I would have preferred that you not come here. I would have preferred that you not bring trouble into my life. I would have preferred not to go to battle with my sister and my niece. And I most certainly would have preferred not to be forced to choose sides.
Sketok folded her arms across her chest and regarded the goddess grimly.
You never did like to choose sides, Hecate. No wonder you have three faces.
Sophie was watching Hecate as Sketok spoke, and for an instant she glimpsed something dark and immeasurably old behind the girl's eyes.
I have survived the millennia because I heeded my own counsel, Hecate snapped, but I have chosen sides when the struggle was worth it.
And now, Nicholas Flamel said very softly, I think it is time to choose again. Only you can decide, however. Is this a worthy struggle?
Hecate ignored the question and spun around to face Sophie and Josh. Her tiny hand moved in the air, and immediately the auras around the twins flared to silver and golden light. She tilted her head to one side, looking at them, watching the silver bubbles crawling along the cocoon that enveloped Sophie, and following the tracery of golden veins that moved up and down Josh's aura.
You may be right, she said eventually. This may indeed be the one spoken of in the cursed codex. It has been many centuries since I've encountered auras so pure. They possess incredible, untapped potential.
Flamel nodded. If I had the time, I would take them to be properly trained, gradually awaken their dormant powers. But events have conspired against me, and time is that one precious commodity I do not have. It is within your power to unlock their potential. You can do something in an instant that it would normally take years to do.
Hecate glanced over her shoulder at the alchemist.
And there are good reasons why it should take many years, she said dismissively. The Humani barely use their senses. Yet you are proposing to awaken these two to their full potential. I will not do it. The sensory overload could destroy them, drive them mad. But,
Flamel began,
I will not do it.
She turned back to the twins.
What he is asking me to do could kill you, if you are lucky, she said,
and then turned and swept from the room, leaving little grassy footprints in her wake. Chapter 22 The twins were speechless for a moment. Then Josh began.
What did she mean?
But Nicholas hurried past him, following Hecate out into the hallway. She's exaggerating, he called back over his shoulder, trying to frighten you.
Well, it worked, Josh muttered.
He looked at Sketok, but she had turned her back and walked into the garden.
Hey, he called, hurrying after her. Come back. I've got questions.
He felt a quick surge of anger. He was tired of being treated like a child. He and his sister deserved some answers.
Josh, Sophie warned.
But her brother darted past her and reached for Skatok's shoulder. His fingers never even touched her. Suddenly, he was caught, twisted, turned, and then spun through the air. He hit the ground hard enough to drive the breath from his lungs, and he found himself staring down the length of Skatok's sword, the tip of which she held rock steady between his eyes. When she spoke, her voice was little more than a whisper.
Last night, you insulted a goddess of the elder race. Today, you've managed to irritate one of the next generation, and it's not even dawn yet, she added.
The warrior maid sheathed her sword and looked over at a stunned Sophie.
She hadn't even seen Skatok move.
"Is he always like this?"
Skatty asked.
"Like what?"
Sophie asked.
"Foolish, ill-advised, reckless. Shall I go on?"
"No need, and yes, he's usually like this. Sometimes worse." When they were growing up, she used to tease Josh that he got all the doing genes, whereas she got the thinking genes. Her brother was both impulsive and reckless, but to be fair, she thought, he was also loyal and trustworthy. Skatok pulled Josh to his feet.
"If you continue at this rate, you'll not last long in this world."
"I just wanted to ask you a few questions."
"You're lucky. A couple of centuries ago, I probably would have killed you. I used to have a bit of a temper," she admitted, "but I've been working on my self-control."
Josh rubbed the small of his back. If Skatok had smashed him down on the stones, he could really have been hurt, but he recognized that she'd been careful to drop him onto the grass and moss. "That felt like a judo throw," he said shakily, attempting to sound casual and change the subject.
"Something like that."
"Where did you learn judo anyway?"
"I didn't learn judo. I created the distant ancestor of most of the martial arts that are studied today,"
the red-haired warrior said, bright green eyes flashing wickedly.
"In fact, it would do neither of you any harm if I were to show you a few simple moves."
"I think we can do better than simple," Josh said. "We studied Taekwondo for 2 years when our parents were teaching in Chicago, and we did a year of karate in New York. Or was that Boston?"
"You created judo?"
Sophie asked, keeping her voice carefully neutral.
"No. Kano Jigoro created modern judo, but he based his fighting system on jiu-jitsu, which is related to Aikido, which evolved around the 14th century. I believe I was in Japan around then. All martial arts have a common root, and that's me,"
Skatty said modestly.
"Come, if you know a little Taekwondo,